spurred into Greta's ear. I need your help. Greta backed away, taking Angela's face in her hands. She had the appearance of an alopecia patient. Her eyebrows were missing, and the lashes on her lids were present only in random clusters. Scratch marks climbed her neck and stretched beyond the collar of her sweatshirt. Greta remembered a similar appearance from when she had first met Angela at Bayer Group, but today's version was severely pronounced. We need to call the police. People think you're dead.
No, we can't call the police. We can't call anyone. He can never find us. Promise me, Greta. Promise you'll never let him find us.
Chapter 28. Chicago, November 1st, 2019. Rory pushed the appeals letters to the side and pulled in front of her the stack with Angela Mitchell's name scrawled across the top. The pages chronicled her father's search for the woman after she disappeared in 1979. Rory had been reading these pages the morning Celia found her in her father's office. She had been scanning the names of the people her father contacted during his search when Celia showed up with the safe deposit box's key. Rory forced the rest of it from her mind. The idea that her father was subtly trying to keep Thomas Mitchell in jail, and concentrated only on that which was in front of her. There was something ominous about seeing proof that her father had been searching for Angela Mitchell. Catherine Blackwell's notes left little doubt that it was true, but some part of Rory refused to believe it. Now, as she sat staring at her late father's notes that recorded his search for Angela, she could no longer deny it. The woman was out there somewhere. Rory read about her father's trip to St. Louis to talk with Angela's parents. She read about his visit to Catherine Blackwell's house on the north side of Chicago. She read about his trip to a psychiatric hospital where Angela had been treated when she was a teenager. Rory poured through her father's investigation into the whereabouts of Angela Mitchell with a rabid thirst for details, turning the pages with fervor and frenzy, until she came to the name of a nurse. The nurse who had driven Angela Mitchell away from the hospital on her 18th birthday. Rory's vision funneled, until a strange kaleidoscope of images danced in front of her when she saw the woman's name. Margaret Schreiber. She had trouble breathing, her lungs heavy with panic and confusion, unable to expand or contract. Her father had been searching for Angela Mitchell, retracing her life and following her past to a juvenile psychiatric hospital, where she had been befriended by the woman Rory had believed her whole life to be her great aunt, but whose identity had been blurred by the adoption papers and birth certificates. None of it registered in Rory's mind. Her confusion could be chalked up to denial, but she knew it was more than that. She had been trained to see things others did not, to root through details of cases and reconstruct a picture of events that was invisible to others. But discovering a connection between Greta and Angela sent her mind spiraling. A deep ache started below her sternum and rose like bubbling lava from the crater of a long, dormant volcano. Rory couldn't remember the last panic attack she'd had. It would have been as a child. It would have been before she found the healing outlet in the upstairs room of Greta's farmhouse. She swallowed the rest of her dark lord, hoping the fluid would physically wash away the rising fear and that the alcohol would dull her senses. She ran to the refrigerator and popped the top on another beer, stood in the darkened kitchen and raised the bottle to her mouth. In a few swallows, it was half gone. Dizzy, she stumbled to her den and clicked on the lights. She stared at the china dolls that lined the shelves. The room was a replica of the farmhouse, and she hoped the sight of the restored dolls would dampen the panic that coursed through her body. Rory needed to occupy her mind with something other than thoughts of Greta and her parents, and how they might be linked to Angela Mitchell. Having just completed the restoration of Camille Bird's doll, she had no current projects to work on. She opened the chest that sat in the corner and pulled out a doll she had purchased at auction. It was tattered and ruined and would take a great deal of skill and concentration to restore. Rory sat at her workbench and tried to analyze the damage, but her mind would not take the bait. The usual lure of the doll's needs was trumped tonight by the discovery that Greta had known Angela. Her go-to method of skirting a panic attack was failing. She left the den, grabbed another Dark Lord, and ran out to her car. She pulled from the curb with her headlights bringing to life the dark and empty Chicago streets. She drove without thinking. She knew the address from the file. It was on the north side. She took side streets and tried to control her speed. She was in no condition to be behind the wheel, both from too many Dark Lords and because she was not in her right mind. 20 minutes later, she pulled past the bungalow where Angela Mitchell had lived in 1979. The houses were close together, and the entire block was silent and dark, with only front porch lights shining in the darkness. Rory stared at the front of the house for a few minutes, sensing the strong connection she had felt since first learning about Angela Mitchell. A relationship had formed, like with the subjects of the crime she reconstructed between her and Angela. Rory felt an obligation to find the woman, to let her know that there was someone who understood her struggles and her pain. Pulling past the house, she turned the corner and crept into the alley behind the home. A chain-link fence protected the small backyard of Angela Mitchell's previous residence. A detached garage opened into the alley. Rory stood from her car and walked in front of it. She stared at the back of the home. She wondered what had transpired here all those years ago, and how it was connected to all the people in her life. The car's headlights cast her shadow along the pavement of the alley, her legs forming an inverted V. As Rory stared at her shadow, she sensed something inside her, something tugging for her attention. She could not place the feeling or determine why the sight of her shadow gave her such a chill until she realized that the headlights threw a silhouette on the ground in the exact same way Thomas Mitchell designed his A's in his perfect block penmanship with no crosshatch. A. Then it occurred to her. As she stood in the dark alley and stared at her shadow, she realized that she had not only come to Angela's home, but to Thomas Mitchell's as well. The revelation hollowed her chest and gave resurgence to her hyperventilating lungs. But it was impossible for Rory to understand the real reason for her clairvoyance. She was standing in the exact same spot where Angela Mitchell stood 40 years earlier, just as determined to uncover what had happened to the women who went missing that summer as Rory was today. The back porch light came on and caught her attention. Then the kitchen window flashed with light from inside. The rear door opened.
"Can I help you with something?" a man yelled from the doorframe. "Or maybe I should call the cops and see if they can help. Or maybe I'll come out there and utilize my Second Amendment rights for someone trespassing on my property."
Jolted by the sudden confrontation, Rory turned and hurried back into her car, her shadow darting and then disappearing.
"Get the hell out of here!"
she heard the man yell as she climbed behind the wheel. She pulled out of the alley, sideswiping a trash can in the process. Chicago, May 1982. Frank and Marla remained on the couch as Greta told her story. Marla leaned forward when she asked her next question.
"Angela Mitchell was never killed by her husband?"
"No," Greta said. "But he would have killed her if she hadn't left." Marla took a quick glance at her husband, then back to Greta.
"What happened to her?"
Greta hesitated.
Where is she, Greta? And what does it have to do with our adoption? Greta shook her head, looked over at Frank as well. Frank nodded.
We need to know everything, Greta. I made a promise to help you, but we both have to hear the whole story.
Greta took another sip of coffee and then gently replaced the cup on the saucer.
After Angela told me, I knew there was no turning back.
2 days after Angela appeared in her driveway, Greta drove to the reservoir that sat a mile from the farmhouse. Angela followed in her own car. They waited until dusk, until the summer sky was brushed lavender and the clouds caught the remnants of the setting sun on their underbellies and blushed a cherry red. It was just dark enough to provide cover, but light enough to guide their actions. Greta parked 100 yards from the reservoir and then climbed into the passenger seat of Angela's car for the last leg of the journey. Angela pulled her car over the long grass and to the edge of the drop-off that led to the water. They both got out. Greta looked around to make sure they were alone. Then she reached through the driver's side window to make sure the car was in neutral. They positioned themselves behind the rear bumper, dug their heels into the ground, and pushed. When the front wheels crested the bank, gravity took over. Greta and Angela watched as the car careened into the reservoir and disappeared beneath the water. They waited for 10 minutes as the water bubbled while the car released trapped air from below. When it became too dark to see the disturbance on the surface, they walked to Greta's car. On the way back to the farmhouse, Greta looked over at Angela.
How far along are you?
I'm not sure.
Have you been vomiting?
Yes, Angela said. For a couple of weeks. I thought it was nerves until the doctor called.
Okay, Greta said. Probably a month or two. That means you're due in the spring. We'll have no problem delivering in my house. I've done it dozens of times.
Our issue will be keeping you and the baby hidden. We'll have to file the proper documentation.
And even if we skip that process, eventually there will be school registration and life in general.
I can keep you hidden, for a while anyway. Everyone thinks you're dead.
But after you deliver, we'll have to figure out a long-term plan. Hiding a child is nearly impossible.
He can never know he has a child, Greta. Promise me you'll find a way.
Greta nodded her head slowly. She had no idea how she could agree to something so impossible. But still, she said, I promise.
Chapter 29. Chicago, November 1st, 2019. Rory pulled her car to the front of her house, the passenger side wheel hopping the curb as she did so. She stumbled up the stairs, keyed the front door, and headed up to her bedroom. She hadn't experienced such a powerful attack since childhood, and she understood the devastating effects they could have if she failed to stifle it. She fell into bed. Rising above the white noise in her mind, above the revelation that her parents had hidden her adoption, beyond the notion that Aunt Greta was not the person she had always believed her to be, and louder than the incessant whispers that she was due in front of Judge Boyle and the parole board with Thomas Mitchell tomorrow, were the unrelenting calls from Angela Mitchell. Atop the panic was the lure of a mysterious woman who was somehow linked to all the people Rory had loved in her life. It was a pull Rory could not ignore. It reminded her of her childhood, when a similar sensation had taken hold of her. She folded the pillow over her head and pressed it to her ears to quiet the whispers that came from within. Rory worked to control her breathing. She closed her eyes and cleared her thoughts. There was a process, a way to manage the attacks. She tried to remember the tricks, the breathing exercises that always brought her to a proverbial fork in the road.
In one direction was a restless night during which her mind would not cease, with wild and relentless thoughts keeping her awake. In the other direction was the calming lure of sleep and the charm of shutting down her brain, allowing dreams to run effortlessly through the folds of her mind. She worked for 30 minutes on her breathing, pushing all other thoughts from her mind other than an image of her lungs expanding and contracting. Finally, she skirted onto this other road, the peaceful road, and soon her breathing was deep and rhythmic. Rory woke in the bedroom of the old farmhouse. It happened every so often, a few times every summer. Aunt Greta would put her to bed, tuck her in, and shut off the lights. "Remember," Aunt Greta would say, standing in the doorway, "nothing can scare you unless you allow it to scare you." Greta would close the bedroom door, and Rory would fall peacefully to sleep, the way she always did during her stays at the farmhouse, where the angst and worry had never been able to find her. Rory would typically sleep straight through until morning. But tonight was one of the times she woke in the small hours of night, her body filled with energy that put a buzz in her chest and in her head and in her fingers and toes. She literally vibrated with vigor, overcome with an awesome desire to explore. The sensation had her tossing and turning in bed. The first few times she had encountered this phenomenon, Rory fought against it. She kicked the covers and reset the pillows until sunlight filled the window frame the next morning, spilling around the blinds to finally push away the urge to wander into the night and discover the source of her unrest. Rory was careful never to mention this feeling of angst to anyone. Her parents sent her to Aunt Greta's farmhouse to escape the anxiety she felt during the rest of her life, to dispel it, really. And if they knew about these rare bouts of midnight disquiet, they might decide that Rory's visits to Aunt Greta's were no longer serving their purpose. She loved her long weekends and summers in this peaceful place, so Rory kept the odd nights of sleeplessness a secret. That, and because describing the middle of the night sensation as anxiety wasn't quite right, Rory felt no worry when these spells of wakefulness came to her at the farmhouse, only the temptation of the unknown and the call for her to climb from bed and explore its meaning. She was 10 years old the night she decided to give in to the lure. When Rory woke, fully alert and without a trace of grogginess, the bedside clock told her it was 2:04 a.m. Her chest vibrated with the familiar curiosity she had come to know after many summers at her aunt's farmhouse. Throwing the covers aside, she climbed from bed, pulled by an invisible need. She opened her bedroom door and endured the whine of the hinges. She crept silently past Aunt Greta's bedroom, beyond the second doorway that led to the workshop, where the restored dolls stood in perfect rows on the shelves and down the stairs. She opened the back door and slipped out into the night. The stars shimmered down on her from the heavens, obscured occasionally by thin sheets of shadowed clouds traced silver by the moon. Far off in the distance, a lightning storm ignited the horizon with off-and-on flickers of brightness, delivering a low rumble of thunder minutes later. Standing on the back porch, Rory gave in to the pull in her chest. Her feet followed like a magnet drawn to a giant slab of faraway metal. She walked without effort through the field behind the house, found the low, two-rung wooden fence at the edge of the property, and followed it, her hand gliding over its smooth surface as she walked. Near the back of the property, where the fence cornered and turned at a 90-degree angle, Rory found what was summoning her. On the ground, she saw the flowers she had watched Aunt Greta collect earlier in the day. Every morning, Rory observed Greta gather flowers from the garden. It was Rory's job to bundle them with twist ties. Rory always asked Greta about the flowers, and she had asked that day as well. She questioned what Greta did with them each day and where they ended up. Rory's inquisitions were met with vague answers. Tonight, however, she found them. The roses had been placed on the ground in a gentle heap, isolated and alone in the back corner of the property. Another lightning strike appeared far off on the horizon, adding just enough light to the gray glow of the moon to bring to life the cherry petals. Rory crouched down and removed a rose from the bunch, lifted it to her nose, and inhaled the sweetness. The buzzing in her chest dissipated, and a soothing calm came over her. The feeling of tranquility had always drawn her back to her great aunt's farmhouse. Tonight, under the tarnished glow of the moon, she harnessed that serenity in a single rose placed to her nose. When another lightning strike brightened the area, Rory bent down and gently replaced the rose on the pile, then turned and ran back through the gray night until she reached the house. She climbed into bed. Sleep came instantly. Throughout the rest of her childhood, and for all the remaining summers that Rory stayed at Greta's farmhouse, the mysterious middle-of-the-night insomnia never again found her. Chicago, May 1982.
"I'm going to quit my job,"
Frank said.
"I need to leave Garrison Ford."
"To get away from him?" Marla asked. Her eyes were red-rimmed from crying.
"No, to take him with me. I need to keep Thomas Mitchell as close as possible if this is going to work. I need to be the only one he hires to look for Angela, the only one he trusts."
"He'll never stop looking," Greta said.
"Angela was adamant about that. If it's not Frank, then it will be someone else." "I need to control the information he receives," Frank continued. "He needs to believe I'm making progress. I'll find something to feed him for a while, but ultimately my search will come up empty. I'll make him believe me. What's important is for him to think I'm looking for her. As long as he believes this, he won't look himself. He won't employ anyone else. The man trusts me, and I plan to build and keep that trust."
"For how long?"
"For her entire life," Frank said.
Marla looked off. Her eyes wandered to the stairs, and Frank knew she was thinking of the child sleeping in her crib. "What will we do for money, Frank? How will we support ourselves?"
"I'll hang my own shingle. I've got enough experience to go off on my own. And he's willing to pay me for my services."
"Thomas Mitchell?"
"Yes. He needs an attorney to file his appeals and handle his finances. And he'll pay me on the side to continue my search. He'll be my first client."
"Frank," Marla said, "it's just not what I imagined."
"Please," Greta said, looking at Marla. "I need your help. We need your help.
You're the perfect couple to love this child.
Imagine what sort of life she might have if the truth is ever discovered. Imagine if the public discovers that Thomas has a child from the wife he was imprisoned for killing. And how could she ever live a normal life, knowing her father killed a string of women?"
Marla began crying again. All three of them had been pulled into an impossible situation. All three thought of the child sleeping peacefully in her crib, an innocent child who deserved none of what waited for her. Marla slowly shifted her gaze to Greta.
"Where is she? Where's Angela?"
Greta let out a long breath, and then it was she who began to cry.
"I tried to save her. There was too much blood."
Something was wrong. The bleeding was intense and constant as Greta examined Angela's pelvis. Preeclampsia had forced bed rest for the past few weeks, and spotting had gotten Greta concerned. But Angela had insisted Greta treat her without involving a physician. It was too risky, she had argued. And Greta couldn't disagree that with Angela's face on the news during Thomas's trial, she would be immediately recognized. So Greta had treated the blood pressure issues, forced bed rest, and monitored her like a hawk. But Angela had woken tonight, her water having broken. She was hemorrhaging badly. Now she was in the throes of delivery.
Push, Angela, push.
I can't, Angela said. She was covered in sweat as she lay on the bed. A surgical gown hung in front of her to block the view of her lower half. Greta's head was only intermittently visible as she worked to deliver the baby.
I know it hurts, but you have to push, Angela.
No, I can't. I just can't.
Okay, Greta said, shaking her head. We're going to the hospital, sweetheart. Something is wrong. You're bleeding too much.
No, we can't go to the hospital. He'll be set free, and he'll know about the baby. Please.
Greta looked back down. The hemorrhaging had intensified. She swallowed down the fear that rose in her throat, then nodded her head. She worried about the baby, but more so about Angela. Her home, despite the equipment she had gathered over the past few months, was simply not equipped to handle such complications. Greta was not equipped either.
Then I need you to push. Do you hear me?
Angela did. She pushed and pushed. Part 4. The Choice. Chapter 30. Chicago, November 2nd, 2019. The courtroom hearing was a formality, completely unnecessary, and the last place Rory wanted to be this morning. Still reeling from her panic attack, mildly hungover and with her mind squarely preoccupied with the enigmatic dream she'd had the night before, she was desperate to get to the nursing home and ask Greta about her connection to Angela Mitchell. But Frank Moore had agreed to this hearing months ago as a way to provide a final voice to the board members, who were allowing this man to walk free 2 decades before his sentence was complete. Present with Rory in the courtroom were the 6 members of the parole board, a designated representative from the district attorney's office, who looked like he was straight out of law school, and a court clerk, as well as Naomi Brown and Ezra Parker, a social worker and parole officer who had accompanied Rory to the Starved Rock cabin. They all wore some form of appropriate attire for a courtroom, except Rory. She looked more like the parolee than his attorney, dressed as she was in gray jeans and a dark t-shirt. She couldn't get away with wearing her beanie hat in court, so she allowed her wavy brunette hair to fall to either side of her face, like barely parted window curtains. She made sure her glasses were in place, and when she walked into the courtroom, her combat boots rattled and drew everyone's attention. She had warned Judge Boyle that she was not meant for a courtroom. The stares would normally have sent her into a state of panic, but she spent most of her angst during the height of her attack the previous night, when she drunkenly drove to Angela Mitchell's old house. It had once been Thomas Mitchell's house as well, she thought, just as the side door of the courtroom opened and 2 bailiffs appeared. They led Thomas Mitchell into court and sat him next to Rory. Judge Boyle materialized through a different door and took his spot on the bench.
Good morning, the judge said, his voice echoing through the nearly empty courtroom. This will be a brief hearing.
The judge kept his gaze on the papers in front of him and never looked up to see those present in his courtroom. He appeared to be as excited about this morning's proceedings as Rory.
Ms. Moore, I've brought the board up on the latest circumstances of the passing of Mr. Mitchell's previous attorney, and that as his new representative you've agreed to all the previous stipulations.
They covered again the living arrangements, regular check-ins with the parole officer, restriction on drugs and alcohol, drug testing, and on and on.
Yes, sir,
Yes, ma'am, Thomas said, whenever a member of the board addressed him.
The formalities took 15 minutes. Once everyone was satisfied, the judge shuffled some papers.
Mr. Mitchell, your release tomorrow will be tricky, Judge Boyle said. There is intense media attention surrounding the exact details, and Ms. Moore and I have discussed the importance of you staying anonymous. The press release lists a 10 a.m. release. I'd like to keep that as the formal time listed, but release you instead at 4:30 a.m. It will still be dark. The warden has agreed to this and to an east side exit. I think this will be the best way to keep things discreet and allow you to get to your residence without notice.
Unstated but agreed upon long ago was that his attorney would be the one driving him from jail. He had no one else in his life. And now Thomas Mitchell no longer had Frank Moore. Judge Boyle looked at Rory.
Transportation has been arranged?
Rory nodded.
Mr. Mitchell, you've been an exemplary inmate. The state hereby agrees to your release at 4:30 tomorrow morning, November 3rd. I hope you make much of your life from this point forward. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Your Honor, Thomas said.
The judge banged his gavel and was up and gone, his robe drifting like a cape in the wind. Thomas looked at the board members, bowed his head.
Thank you.
He was gracious and kind, a perfect gentleman, rehabilitated and ready to integrate back into society. Chapter 31, Chicago, November 3rd, 2019. With Lane next to her in bed, Rory watched the bedside clock tick, 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 minute after minute, until it reached 3 o'clock. She hadn't slept, hadn't even closed her eyes. She had considered a middle-of-the-night visit to see Aunt Greta. Greta would typically have been the perfect person to calm Rory's nerves about sitting alone in her car with Thomas Mitchell, but Rory knew that the next time she saw Greta, she needed to take advantage of whatever small window of opportunity presented itself to ask about Angela. She would need to be clear and concise, and to do this, Rory needed to gather her wits. During the dark hours of night, as Lane slept next to her, she decided to tackle the obstacle of delivering Thomas Mitchell to the Starved Rock cabin before seeing Greta. At 3:15 a.m., she pushed the covers to the side and climbed from bed. The warm flow of water crashed over her head. She spent more time in the shower than usual before she finally shut off the spigot and readied herself for what was coming. 20 minutes later, she was dressed in her usual battle gear. She laced up her combat boots and was about to head out the front door and into the darkness when she saw Lane dressed and waiting in the darned front room. He sat with crossed legs and his arm draped over the back of the couch, staring into the black fireplace. What are you doing? Lane turned at the sound of her voice.
Not a chance I'm letting you go by yourself.
Lane, Rory started to say, but he was already up and out the door. A few seconds later, she heard her car door slam. Thank God, she whispered to herself. At 4:15, they pulled to the east gate at Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois, and waited. The headlights illuminated the chain-link fencing. At precisely 4:30 a.m., the side door opened and spilled yellow light into the pre-dawn darkness. Figures appeared, silhouetted by the brightness inside the building that cast their shadows in front of them like long, slender ghosts. The scene brought Rory briefly back to the other night, when she stood in the alley behind Angela's previous home, Thomas Mitchell's home, and stepped in front of her car's headlight to cause her shadow to creep out in front of her. The chain-link fencing parted as the figures approached, and when the group reached the edge of the enclosure, only one of them continued on. Rory's sternum ached as Thomas Mitchell walked through the darkness, opened the door, and climbed into the back seat. The ride to Starved Rock took just over an hour. There was no conversation in the dark car, only the hum of highway as they sped along I-80, guided by the brightness of the headlamps. She took the appropriate exit and navigated the side streets with the aid of Lane's GPS, eventually slowing when she approached the nearly hidden driveway that led to the secluded cabin.
"Wow,"
Thomas said from the back seat. He was staring through the side window. The first glimmers of dawn were on the horizon, ushering away the dark night and replacing it with a soft blue.
"It's been a long time."
Rory didn't know if he was talking about the cabin or the sunrise. She didn't ask, just turned onto the drive. The car rocked as she steered along the canopied drive, finally emerging into the clearing where the A-frame cabin sat in the teal glow of morning. She put the car into park when she reached the end of the driveway, turned and draped her right arm across the front seats so that her hand was touching Lane's shoulder. She handed a key over the seat.
"I only found one key in my father's office."
Thomas took it and climbed from the rear of the vehicle. He carried with him a zipped plastic bag the guards had provided. It represented everything he owned in the world. Rory stood from the driver's seat, popped the trunk, and removed a small backpack. They both approached the front porch.
"There's no food," Rory said.
Her father would have probably stocked the fridge. Rory never considered it. "But there's a convenience store about half a mile down the main road." Thomas nodded.
"I remember."
She handed him an envelope of money she had withdrawn from his account using the password set up by her father. "Here's some cash to get you started. There's also an ATM card in there with access to one of your accounts. Passcode is on a sticky note.
Are you familiar with ATMs?"
He nodded.
"We had a card system inside. I'll figure it out."
"ATM machine is at the convenience store. Food and clothes will be your first necessities." She handed him the backpack. "I put this together for you. It'll do until we can get you a vehicle. But you'll need a driver's license first. We'll have to work on all that. You think you can survive on a week's worth of clothing and the convenience store for a few days while I work out the details?"
"I'll manage. Thank you."
He keyed the front door and stepped inside. After a quick look around, he was back in the doorway.
"Thanks for the lift."
"Answer the phone if it rings. Your parole officer will be calling today to give you instructions. His name is Ezra Parker. You're required to check in with him every day."
"Will do."
"Here's his card. Keep it by the phone." He took the card from her hand.
"Got it."
Rory nodded. "We'll talk soon." It was getting brighter as she walked back to the car. The sun's yellow glimmer through the trees made Rory feel as if she had emerged from a dangerous journey. At just after 8 o'clock a.m., Rory and Lane pulled to the curb outside her house. Her nerves were frayed, she was sleep-deprived, and the adrenaline rush was on a steep decline. She was exhausted when she walked across the front lawn and up the steps to her porch. Lane put his arm around her. With her father gone and Greta too elderly to embrace her, there was only one person left in her life whose touch she enjoyed. She put her head on his shoulder, and they climbed the stairs to her front stoop.
"I'll make coffee?"
Rory asked.
"You don't drink coffee."
"I'll open a couple Diet Cokes."
"No," Lane said. "I've got a class this morning. I'm already late. You should get some sleep. You were up all night."
"I have to see Aunt Greta."
"Now?"
"Something's come up. I have to talk with her."
"Get some sleep. I have a faculty dinner tonight. I'm giving the keynote address. But I'll try to skip out afterward and come see you."
She let him kiss her.
okay? Lane asked.
Rory nodded. Her eyes were droopy with fatigue. Okay. She turned and entered the house. After the door was closed, Lane looked down at the porch, which was covered in ruddy dust. He noticed the trail of blood-red footprints from Rory's boots. They led from the street, across the front lawn, and up to the patio. Chapter 32. Starved Rock, Illinois, November 3, 2019. Thomas Mitchell closed the door to the cabin and watched through the window as Frank Moore's daughter drove the circular path around the cottage and disappeared into the forested drive from which they had come. Once she was gone, he looked around his new home, checking each room. He walked back out onto the front porch and into the dawning morning. It was the first time in 40 years that he witnessed a sunrise. He sucked in the scent of the pine trees, his brain tricking him at first into believing he smelled the usual antiseptic bleach that had greeted him for the last many decades. But no, he tasted only the fresh scents of morning, of freedom, of opportunity. So much had transpired at this place. He had history here, at his uncle's cabin tucked away in the woods, and there was more to come. The final chapter of his life was about to be written here. He planned to find her, to bring her here, the way he should have done years before. He took just a moment to enjoy the rising sun before he went back into the cabin and sat on the couch. Across the coffee table, he spread the contents of the plastic bag the guard had given him when he stood at the precipice of the open gate at Stateville Correctional Center. The trinkets and possessions he had accumulated during his life in prison had been left in his jail cell. He knew the guards had pocketed the knickknacks to sell to rabid fans. The thief still had a following. But all that mattered to him were his papers. The tedious and meticulous notes he had taken over the years. They were a verbatim list of everything he had ever spoken about to Frank Moore. Every lead the attorney had ever brought him during the search for his wife. Every person Frank had contacted. Years of plotting had boiled the list down to an essential few. Thomas knew where to start. He planned to waste no time. 40 years of waiting were about to end. Hours later, the sun was high above, and his white skin burned under the unfamiliar rays. His shirt was soaked through with perspiration as he stepped onto the shovel for the 1,000th time. The mound of dirt had grown thigh high, and it took a good stride down to reach the bottom of the hole. He spent another hour widening it, and another squaring off the corners. It had been so long since he'd dug a grave that he nearly forgot the thrill it brought. It meant the rush was coming. The anticipation surged through him. He swiped his forearm across his face to clear the sweat. Then he speared the shovel into the earth again, and again, and again. Chapter 33. Chicago, November 3rd, 2019. A buzzing woke Rory from a dreamless sleep. The bedroom windows displayed a fading chestnut sky as night fell. The combination of her first panic attack in nearly 3 decades, more than 24 hours without sleep, and the tormented task of driving Thomas Mitchell from jail had resulted in total exhaustion. She was disoriented when she woke. The buzzing came again. She searched for the source until she heard it once more and finally recognized that her phone was vibrating. She grabbed it from her bedside table, expecting to see Lane's number. Instead, though, it was someone else. The series of numbers immediately registered. Dragging the slider to the right, she placed the phone to her ear.
Mr. Bird?
Yes. Hi.
Rory?
Rory waited, still groggy and suddenly aware that she sounded so.
Sorry, did I wake you?
No, she said. There was a long pause as Rory stood from bed and walked to the window. It was past 5:00 p.m. and the sun had set. She realized that she'd slept the entire day.
Hello?
Yes, Rory said. I'm here.
I was calling to get an update about the case, to see if you've made any progress.
Rory blinked the sleep from her eyes. I'm afraid not. I mean, I haven't gotten to it yet, but I promise I will. In the meantime, I've finished Camille's doll. I just need to make some last alterations. I'll call you next week and we'll arrange to meet. There was another pause.
That would be fine.
Rory ended the call. She checked her text messages but found none. She tried Lane but got no answer. His class had ended hours ago. He was probably on his way to dinner. He wouldn't be back for another few hours. She climbed back into bed to wait for him. She needed to close her eyes for just a moment. When she did, it took only seconds for sleep to take her again. Chapter 34, Chicago, November 3rd, 2019. Catherine Blackwell finished the 10:00 news and shut off the television. The lead story had been the release of Thomas Mitchell, a.k.a. The Thief, from Stateville Correctional Center earlier in the day. With no footage of the release, reporters speculated that he had been discharged early in the morning under cover of darkness. That, or there had been a delay. Authorities and prison spokespeople offered no updates and likely would not until the following morning. Still, reporters stood vigil outside the correction center, hoping to break the news if the thief ended up walking from behind the prison walls into the hot lights of their cameras. What a shame, Catherine thought. What a terrible shame. She walked into the kitchen, removed a glass container of milk from the refrigerator and poured it into the bowl on the ground. The sound of the cap suctioning off the jar brought her cat roaming from under the bed in the other room to lap at the cool milk. Catherine went to the sink and placed the empty bottle into the garbage bag, tied it tightly, and carried it to the back door. The cat was immediately on her heels.
You want to explore, don't you?
Catherine said.
Come on.
She opened the back door, and the cat ran out into the night. Catherine walked to the alley behind her house and lifted the top to the large plastic garbage can to drop the bag inside. The cat was at her side again.
Not feeling adventurous tonight? Go find a mouse.
But the cat was unusually needy this evening, not wanting to leave Catherine's side. Catherine sensed something ominous as she stood in the alley. The cat hissed into the night.
What's wrong? What do you see out there?
The cat hissed once more before darting from Catherine's side, swallowed quickly by the black night. As Catherine squinted into the darkness, feet shuffled behind her. She turned quickly, startled. Their eyes met and she let out a short scream, which was quickly stifled by his hand. Chapter 35, Chicago, November 3rd, 2019. Greta Schreiber lay in bed, eyes closed and in a wild state of dementia. Her mind flashed with images from the past, quick bursts of colorful mirages from a previous life.
Where is she?
A voice came from the darkness.
I tried to save you, Greta said. There was too much blood.
The farmhouse flickered in her mind. The makeshift delivery room. Angela lying on the bed. The blood, the doubt, the terror. A grave worry filled Greta's chest, now like it had that day.
Where is she? The voice asked again.
We have to go to the hospital, Greta said. Something's wrong. There's too much blood.
I'll ask one more time, the voice said from the darkness.
You picked her up from the psychiatric hospital. I know she came to you for help. Where is she now?
Greta opened her eyes. The farmhouse disappeared, replaced by a hospital room, a blue glowing television, and a looming figure standing over her bed. The figure leaned closer so that his face was inches from hers.
Where is she?
Greta blinked. Her mind cleared. She knew the face in front of her. She'd seen him on the news all those years ago. He was older now than when she watched updates of his conviction on television while Angela sat next to her. Older than the photos that had appeared in the papers. But she was sure it was him. It was not a surprise that he was here, nor was this day unexpected. Frank had worried about it for years, and had voiced his concern to Greta many times.
Last time, the man said. Where is...
Nowhere. Greta's voice was gravelly and inaudible. The man leaned closer, so that his ear was close to her lips. The blue glow of the television disappeared from Greta's vision when the man bent over her.
Again, he said.
Nowhere you'll ever find her. Nowhere you'll ever go.
The blue light came back as the man stood up. Then it quickly disappeared again. Greta felt the pillow press against her face. She kept her arms at her sides and never tried to resist. Her mind drifted off.
I tried to save you. There was too much blood.
Chapter 36. Chicago, November 4th, 2019. It had been more than 48 hours since her panic attack, and Rory was starting to feel her body balance itself. The sleep had helped, and now she was ready to face the source of her angst. Greta was linked to Angela Mitchell, and Rory had finally made it to the nursing home to ask her about it. Camille Bird's Kestner doll lay in its box on the passenger seat. It would be good ammunition for when Rory asked Greta the tough questions she had planned. Rory would not let her off the hook today. Today she needed answers. She needed to understand the mysterious veil that had fallen over her life, a web that connected everyone she loved to a woman who supposedly died 40 years ago. As she pulled into the lot, Rory saw red flashing lights from an ambulance and fire truck that were parked in the turnabout in front of the building. Greta had been a resident here long enough that red lights and sirens were routine for Rory. Throughout nearly every resident's tenure, they suffered some sort of medical crisis that required a trip to the hospital. Emergency vehicles parked out front were a daily ritual. Rory walked in front of the fire truck, whose engine was roaring. In the lobby, she scribbled her name into the visitor log and paused as she went through the process of printing Greta's name and room number, and then signing her own along the narrow line. Rory had gone through the routine so many times over the years that the practice had attached itself to the image of her aging great aunt, sitting in her room and staring at the blue light of the television. But something caught her attention as she stared at the visitor log today. A vague, subconscious intuition made her hesitate as she penned her name. Before she had a chance to decipher the premonition, Greta's nurse appeared in the corner of Rory's eye. She was walking in a hurried fashion, an urgency to her pace. Rory looked up from the sign-in sheet, dropped the pen to the floor. Things slowed. The rushing nurse took on an underwater motion, her hair flowing behind her in slow motion. Rory felt the woman take her hand, her eyes dripping with sympathy.
I'm afraid your aunt has passed, Rory.
Rory blinked as the world caught up and began again in real time. The noises of the lobby came back to her. The people moved around her with normal gaits and at a normal speed. The framed picture on the lobby wall blinked red with the flashing lights outside.
She was perfectly happy when she went to sleep last night, the nurse said. We found her this morning. She passed overnight, peacefully and with no distress.
Rory stood still and offered no reply. The Kestner doll secured under her arm.
Would you like to see her?
Rory nodded. She would. Chapter 37, Chicago, November 4th, 2019. Rory lay in bed. She couldn't shake the image of the zipper pulling the gap in the body bag together, Aunt Greta's face disappearing. With it, a part of Rory vanished too. She had fought against it when Celia called a month ago to tell Rory that her father was dead. And she battled to prevent it when she walked into her childhood home and was assaulted by memories of a life gone by. She tried to resist again tonight, but had no chance of stopping the tears this time. She cried like she never remembered doing as a child, and had certainly never done as an adult. It wasn't that Rory Moore didn't feel the emotions of pain or sadness. She did. But those things affected her differently than they affected most. Those sensations altered her mood and changed her thinking. They pulled her back from interactions and made her want to hide from the world. They made her want to be alone. Rarely, however, did pain cause the socially accepted form of bereavement, hysterical crying. Tonight was one of those rare occasions. Rory lay on her side, head sunk in the pillow, and wept. So many things were gone. Greta had been Rory's last living relative. Besides Lane Phillips, Rory loved no one else in this world. But the anguish she felt now carried another significance. In addition to the end of her lineage, gone too was Rory's chance for answers about the adoption papers, about Frank and Marla Moore, about her summers at the farmhouse, about her true relationship to Greta, and about Greta's link to Angela Mitchell. Ever since Rory started reconstructing her death, the mysterious woman seemed to be tied to everything in Rory's life. It was a connection that felt otherworldly. Stronger than the usual relationship Rory developed with the victims of the crimes she reconstructed. And so it was that on the night Greta died, she could think of nothing but Angela Mitchell. Regret was her companion as Rory closed her eyes, seasoning the tears that ran down her cheeks to soak the pillow. Soon sleep was pulling her. She surrendered easily to it, because within the slumber was something else. The familiar lure she had known as a child, the temptation that had drawn her from bed and ushered her to the prairie behind the farmhouse where she once found peace. Tonight, though, as her eyes fluttered under her lids, she recognized that it was someone different that pulled her mind. Still, it was irresistible. It was dark and quiet when Rory walked into Grant Park. The Chicago skyline shined in the distance, intermittent windows lit yellow in the skyscrapers that were set against a black sky. Rory squinted against the darkness. She walked past Buckingham Fountain and to the cobblestone path flanked by birch trees until she came to the clearing where Camille Bird's body had been found nearly 2 years prior. The girl was there now, sitting alone in the grassy knoll. The halogen bulb of a lamppost highlighted her body. A brick wall in the background caught her shadow. She looked tranquil with her legs crossed in a yoga pose, a blanket cloaked over her shoulders. The girl lifted a hand when Rory appeared, a gentle wave that filled Rory's heart simultaneously with peace and sorrow. Camille held something in her lap. And as Rory walked onto the grass and approached the girl, she got a better look at what it was. The Kestner doll was splayed over the girl's crossed legs. Camille ran her hand over the doll's knotted hair. Rory squinted in the darkness and saw the jagged fracture down the left side of the doll's face, The eye sockets split open like a chestnut.
I'm sorry I've neglected your case, Rory said. I'm sorry I've ignored you.
The girl smiled. It was a radiant smile that put a serene mood over the area where someone had dumped her body. There was no anger or disappointment in her eyes.
You haven't ignored me, Camille said. You've thought of me more than anyone else.
I promise to get to your case. I promise to find the person who did this to you.
I know you'll come back to me.
Rory took a step closer. The Kestner looked as ruined as the day Walter Byrd had given it to her.
You become close with the people whose deaths you reconstruct.
You always have.
It's the way you figure things out that no one else can.
And you'll solve your own riddle as well. All the answers are in front of you. All the things that are troubling you. All the things that make no sense.
Camille ran her hand over the doll's face. The truth is easy to miss,